Well, today is week two of the series we've actually been in since last fall called The Good and Beautiful Year, which is a series of three books. We started last fall, The Good and Beautiful God, in which we looked at some false narratives, some false beliefs that many people carry about God, what God is like. And we learned that to know what God is like, you need only look at Jesus, because Jesus is the perfect image of what God looks like in human form. Then, in January, we began book two of the series called The Good and Beautiful Life, when we began looking at some of the false narratives that many of us carry about what actually constitutes the good life. How did God intend this life to be lived? And for that, we used the Sermon on the Mount, this talk that Jesus gave. It's found in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, where Jesus lays out what life is supposed to look like in the kingdom of God. Now, last week, we began book three in the series called The Good and Beautiful Community. And what we're learning and what we're going to unpack over the next 6 weeks or so is that this life that God calls us to is intended to be lived out together with a group of people that we call the church, the people of God, the community of faith. What does God want this community to look like, the good and beautiful community? Today, I want to address a subject that I think is important for all of us, probably specifically important for a few people that are here this morning. I don't know who you are. I didn't single you out as I was writing this, but I just know that the subject is pertinent. It speaks to all of us at one time or another. The subject is hope. The people of God exist as a community of hope. That's what sustains us. It's what keeps us going. But it's also supposed to be one of the primary messages that we communicate to the world, the message of hope for the hopeless. I want to read as we get into this, and I'll read it as we get into the outline, some verses from Hebrews chapter 11. If you want to find that in your Bible, and just hold your finger there, the verses will also be up here on the screen. But Hebrews 11. Let me begin this by asking a question. What are you looking forward to in 2014? That's usually a question we ask more toward the beginning of the year, and we're almost halfway through, it feels like. But still, there's something probably that you're looking forward to, a vacation this summer, a visit from a friend, perhaps, a new business venture that you're about to get into. All of us need something to look forward to, don't we? The human tendency is always to make plans and then anticipate. We're dreamers, we're travelers, and the destination is always just around the next bend. It's just over the horizon. I remember my friend John Zirkle and I in college. I was probably a sophomore, a wise fool. John was a year older than me, so I don't know what his excuse was. But I remember when we first kind of ran across this realization that this is human nature. We called it the anticipation syndrome, that we always are making plans. And as soon as you reach one goal, something you've been looking forward to, you quickly replace it with something else, because we seem to derive more joy, more pleasure out of the planning, out of the looking forward, than we do actually achieving what we've been looking forward to. The anticipation syndrome. I think maybe we were just overly influenced by Carly Simon, perhaps. or Fleetwood Mac, "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow." But we thought we were really on to something. Turns out the great writers and philosophers have been thinking about this for generations, right? Hundreds of years. One of my favorite quotes, and you'll hear me say this a lot, stick around. I don't mean just today. I mean for years to come. Robert Louis Stevenson said, "To travel hopefully is better than to arrive." You ought to write that down and stick it on your refrigerator. We bought a new refrigerator, and it has this stainless steel door, and the magnets don't stick anymore. I'm going to take it back. Refrigerators are only incidentally for the purpose of keeping food cold. Their real purpose is magnets. And somebody really made a mistake with this stainless steel stuff. I don't understand that. If you want to invent something really useful in this world, invent stainless steel that still takes magnets. That would be great. Actually, they already have it. It's called cheap stainless steel. So, another great quote. Actually, I'm not sure this is a direct quote, but he said something like this. The great Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but must be lived forwards." And that's the rub, isn't it? Right? We see very clearly the meaning and the pattern if we look backward. Everything makes sense, but you don't get to live it backward. You have to live it facing forward and moving into the unknown future. So we find ourselves looking back to gain understanding and perspective, and yet we can never quite shake this tendency to look ahead and to anticipate. And do you know the reason, or at least one of the reasons, why we do this? And I really believe this. It's because we are made in the image of God. And God is a dreamer. He never stands in the past calling us back to some golden age, some idealized time from our history. No, He always stands in the future, calling us, beckoning us forward into something more, something better than the past or even the present. I don't care how good you think we have it now or how good we had it in the past, the best is yet to come. It always is for the people of God. This is the purpose of prophecy. It's not to predict the future. That's a complete misunderstanding of what true biblical prophecy is all about. It's not prediction. It's imagination. It's to get us to imagine a preferred future, a better future that is possible. And then we roll up our sleeves and go to work to create it, to participate with God in bringing it about. And that inspires us to keep going. You may already have this verse on your refrigerator, Jeremiah 29:11. You know it? God says, "I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope," there's that word, "and a future." Do you know the context of that verse? Go back and read it in the whole chapter of Jeremiah chapter 29. This was spoken to the people of Israel when they were exiles in Babylon. They had been uprooted from their homeland and carried hundreds of miles away and living in exile in a foreign land. And yet the prophet Jeremiah stood up and said to them the words of God, "There is still a future for you. This is not the end. I have plans to prosper you." Isaiah spoke the same thing during the same period. Isaiah 43, this is what the Lord says. He who made a way through the sea, a path through the mighty waters, who drew out the chariots and horses, the army and reinforcements together, and they lay there, never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick. Now, what's he referring to? In the past, what event is he referring to? You guys know. This is the crossing of the Red Sea, when God had led the people of Israel out of captivity in Egypt. Now God says through the prophet, the one who did that now has something new to say to you. God's just reminding them of who he is. The one who did mighty things in the past now has something new to say to you. And what is it? Forget all that. I love this. Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. Behold, I'm doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the desert and streams in the wasteland. God is inspiring the captives in Babylon. You remember how awesome and wonderful it was when I did that for you in the past. Well, now I'm going to do it again. Only it's going to be different. This time I will make a way not through the sea, but through the desert. That's significant because now there was no sea separating them from the promised land. There was this vast desert. And they couldn't even begin to imagine. Even if we were released from captivity, how would we cross that? And God says, I'll make a way even through the wilderness and streams in the dry land. God has a great future planned for you, for us. And this is the source of our hope. I want to show you three things about this subject of hope from Hebrews chapter 11. The first is this: God's plans go beyond our wildest dreams. God's plans for our future go beyond our wildest dreams. Hebrews 11, beginning with verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise, for he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. The question is, why would Abraham go through such hardship, setting out, not even knowing where he was going, traveling to a place he'd never seen, and when he arrived there, he never even owned any of it, but instead lived out his life as a tent, a wanderer, like a stranger in a foreign country? Why did he do it? The text says, because he saw something. He saw a glorious city shimmering on the horizon of his dreams. A city, it says, whose architect and builder is God himself. It's interesting to me that this Bedouin wanderer, Abraham, who never owned a single piece of land except the burial plot that he bought for his wife Sarah when she died. That's the only piece of land he ever owned. He dreamed of a city, which must have represented for him a place of permanence, see, security, rest. What would a city like that look like? I think of the description of the New Jerusalem in Revelation chapter 21. It says, "The angel showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. The wall was made of jasper, and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. The foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made of a single pearl. The great street of the city was of gold, as pure as transparent glass." Imagine that. It sounds like the Emerald City, doesn't it? From Oz. You know that's what you thought of. Well, you did now. But remember, this is not a description of heaven. The text says it was coming down out of heaven to earth. The early Church of God preachers interpreted this as a vision of what? The church. This is a description of the bride of Christ coming down out of heaven from God, beautifully adorned for her husband. This is the description of God's dream for the future of humanity and the role the church will play in it. It's interesting that the story of the Bible begins in a garden but ends in a city. Now, I know some of you country folk don't think that sounds very appealing, but it's just a metaphor. It's just an image. It's a picture of life together in community, living together with others in one, under Christ as head, with everything unified in oneness under Him. This dream is straight from the heart of God, and it goes beyond our wildest dreams. God's plans for you will always be beyond your wildest dreams. You knew that, don't you? I mean, think about it. Your wildest dreams are still what? They're still your dreams. But God's dreams are beyond even imagining. We can only glimpse them from a distance by revelation as God plants in our imagination a little piece of His glorious future for us. God's plans for this church are beyond our wildest dreams. Did you know that? What would a church look like whose architect and builder is God? And you know, of course, I'm not talking about the building. I'm talking about the people. How would such a church function? What would we look like? What would a church look like that's shaped by God's heart? I want to share four things. There's probably a lot more, but these are the ones that are foremost in my heart, in my mind. First, I think it would be a missional community, always conscious of our calling to join God on His mission out there in the world. Not just about what we do when we gather in this place, but what we do when we leave this place. It would be a missional community. Second, it would be a church for others. Not just providing programming for ourselves. Someone said many years ago that the church is the only organization that exists for the benefit of people who are not yet part of it. Think about that. A church for others, not just for us. Third, it would be a community of servants, sacrificially serving the community, not just each other, and in ways that often inconvenience us. Fourth, it would be a community of love with Calvary quality, selfless love permeating everything that we do. Wouldn't you like to be a part of a community like that? Friends, this is what God dreams. This is part of His plan for blessing the whole earth, is to have communities in every place on earth that function like that. God's plans go beyond our wildest dreams. Second, God's plans go beyond our deepest failures. This is what I think several of you here this morning need to hear. God's plans for you go beyond your deepest failures. Reading on in Hebrews 11 with verse 11. By faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. This is referring to the birth of Isaac, the miracle child of Abraham and Sarah, who was born to them in their old age. The promise came to them when Abraham was 75 and Sarah was 65, and they had never had children their whole life. Sarah was thought to be barren. And yet God came to them and said, you will conceive a child and you will become the father of nations. The promise to Abraham. Now, both of them had trouble believing that. Duh. And it actually turns out that they had to wait how many years before the child was born? Do you remember? 25 years later. Isaac was born when Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 90. That's okay, you can snicker. But do you remember what happened during that long 25 years of waiting? Both of them lost hope. Both of them. And finally, Sarah said, Abraham, this is not going to happen. So here, I have an idea. Here is my servant, Hagar, which was a woman. Don't name your little daughter Hagar when she comes along. That's one of the first problems in this story, I think. Sarah said, here's my servant Hagar. Sleep with her and have children by her to be your heirs, because they're not going to come from me. Now, to be fair, in the ancient world, this was not uncommon. A man could bear children by any number of sources, including multiple wives, and they were all his heirs. But God had already made them a promise. They lost faith. Sarah says here, sleep with Hagar, have children by her. And Abraham, the father of the faithful, said, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Typical male. And another race of people came from that child, Ishmael. And pick up the morning paper today. You can probably read something about the conflict that has been going on for thousands of years. It's tragic. But by the way, I don't mind reminding you, we who call ourselves followers of Jesus need to be reminded of this, that God promised Hagar and the little boy Ishmael, that he would also make of them a great nation. He said, I will not curse you because of Abraham's folly. I'll take care of you also. Listen, friends, God isn't done with the Arab people. God is the God of history, and He's still working things out toward the glorious future that He has for everyone. And we have to be very careful about our attitudes toward the Arab people. Okay, that's another whole subject, and I won't unpack that anymore today, but I need to say that. I need to say that with some regularity, I think. The point is, God's plans for Abraham and Sarah were not even sidetracked by their own stupidity. That's good news. This story in the Old Testament is a story about God's grace. In the New Testament, Jesus said essentially the same thing to His disciples when He was preparing them for His death. Mark chapter 14, He said, "You will all fall away. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." In other words, what was Jesus saying? I still have plans for you beyond your failure. You're all going to fail. You're all going to deny me. You're all going to fall away. But I'll meet you in Galilee and we'll pick it up from there. Isn't that incredible? And then, two chapters later, after Jesus' resurrection, listen to the angels' words to the women. They said, "Go tell His disciples and Peter." Singled out Peter, who was probably the worst of the deniers, the one who failed the most on the night Jesus was betrayed and executed. "Go and tell His disciples and Peter, He's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see Him just as He told you." Listen, here's what I want you to hear this morning. No matter how badly you have failed, Jesus still has plans for you. He is not done with you. He will never throw you out on the scrap heap of life. You say, "But surely there's a limit to what He can do with me now." Have you read the Bible? These people were a mess. They were just like us, only more so. And I take great encouragement from reading what God was able to do with people who failed miserably, repeatedly, many of them. There is no limit to God's grace. God's plans for you beyond your failures still go beyond your wildest dreams. Now that's a quote from Greg Kendall, and you ought to write it down and put it on your refrigerator. God's plans for you beyond your failures are still beyond your wildest dreams. Number three, God's plans go beyond even death itself. Hebrews 11, verse 13. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they're looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Never stop dreaming about a bright tomorrow, even on your deathbed, because the best is always yet to come. Friends, this is the hope that sustains us as the people of God. The Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 8, "In this hope we are saved." It's always having something to look forward to that keeps us going through life. And one of our dearest hopes, fondest dreams, is an eternity with God Himself. I think the best descriptions of heaven are always metaphor, poetry, imagery, because the truth is, we haven't imagined. Paul said that too, right? No mind has conceived, no one has imagined what God has prepared for those who love Him. But the artists, the poets, the writers, the novelists have given us some beautiful imagery of what heaven is like, what awaits us beyond death's door. And one of my favorites, of course, is written by C.S. Lewis in his little series of children's books, The Chronicles of Narnia. This is seven little stories. I hope you've read them. What are they teaching kids in school these days? Lewis himself said that. Seven little stories about the four Pevensey children, Peter and Susan, Edmund and Lucy, who stumbled into this magical land called Narnia through the wardrobe door. And Narnia was this magical place inhabited by lots of talking animals, magical creatures, presided over by the great lion, Aslan, who in the stories we learn is an allegory. He's the Christ figure in the stories. And so we read about all their adventures, but you come to the last book, called The Last Battle. And you read through this one and find that the children and the Narnian creatures have fought the last battle and have lost. And one by one, they are forced at point of sword to enter through the stable door, which represents for them terror. They're horribly afraid because it's the doorway of death. But one by one, they step through it and realize on the other side that all their fears were for nothing because they've entered into this glorious place that is Narnia again, only different. This Narnia is bigger by far, colors more vivid. It's more real. It's more substantial than the world outside the stable door. The last chapter of the book starts with one of the greatest lines in all of English literature. You want something else to put on your refrigerator? Here's a great line. It says, "If one could run without getting tired, I don't think one would often want to do anything else." Which, of course, recalls for us the joy of childhood, right? What 3-year-old ever walks anyplace? You don't walk. You run. Why? Because running is more fun. The only problem is when you run, eventually you get tired. Unless you could run and not grow weary. You could walk and not faint. And so that's what happens. The children and all their Narnian friends, in their joy, take off running. And they begin running across this fascinating landscape, meadows strewn with wildflowers. They run right up the sides of steep mountains. They run right across the surface of glimmering lakes. They swim straight up waterfalls, always further up, further in the land of Narnia. Until finally they arrive at the top of the highest mountain, so they thought, and find there a walled garden, this beautiful paradise garden, surrounded by a wall, and they're invited to enter. We pick up the story. About a half an hour later, or it might have been half a hundred years, for time there is not like time here, Lucy stood with her dear friend, her oldest Narnian friend, the fawn, Tumnus, looking down over the wall of that garden and seeing all Narnia spread out below. But when you looked down, you found that this hill was much higher than you had thought. It sank down with shining cliffs, thousands of feet below them, and trees in that lower world looked no bigger than grains of green salt. Then she turned inward again and stood with her back to the wall and looked at the garden. "I see," she said at last, thoughtfully. "I see now. This garden is like the stable. It is far bigger inside than it was outside." "Of course, daughter of Eve," said the fawn. "The further up and the further in you go, the bigger everything gets. The inside is larger than the outside." Lucy looked hard at the garden and saw that it was not really a garden at all, but a whole world with its own rivers and woods and sea and mountains. But they were not strange. She knew them all. "I see," she said. "This is still Narnia, and more real and more beautiful than the Narnia down below, just as it was more real and more beautiful than the Narnia outside the stable door. I see, world within world, Narnia within Narnia." "Yes," said Mr. Tumnus, "like an onion, except that as you continue to go in and in, each circle is larger than the last." And soon they found themselves all walking together. And a great bright procession it was, up toward mountains higher than you could see in this world, even if they were there to be seen. But there was no snow on those mountains. There were forests and green slopes and sweet orchards and flashing waterfalls, one above the other, going up forever. The light ahead was growing stronger. Lucy saw that a great series of many colored cliffs led up in front of them like a giant's staircase. But then she forgot everything else, because Aslan himself was coming, leaping down from cliff to cliff like a living cataract of power and beauty. Aslan turned to them and said, "You do not yet look so happy as I mean you to be." Lucy said, "We're so afraid of being sent away, Aslan. You have sent us back into our own world so often." "No fear of that," said Aslan. "Have you not guessed?" Their hearts leaped, and a wild hope rose within them. "There was a real railway accident," said Aslan softly. "Your father and mother and all of you are, as you used to call it in the Shadowlands, dead." The term is over. The holidays have begun. The dream is ended. This is the morning. And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion, but the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful, I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories. And we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, It was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. Let's pray. God, every one of us this morning needs to be inspired with hope. Things happen to us in this world, God, sometimes tragic things, sometimes the outcome of our own stupidity. God, we need to be inspired by hope. We need to know that the best is yet to come. We need to know that your plans for us go beyond our wildest dreams, beyond our failures, and beyond even death itself. God, fill us this morning with hope. Inspire us with the dreams of your future for us, on earth while we're yet here, and then beyond death's door. In this hope, we are saved, and we need it desperately. God, make us to be a community of hope, encouraging one another as we walk together through this world, but also holding out hope to the community around us. Let everyone who walks through these doors, God, be inspired by the future you have planned for them. Let us be a people who speak hope in a hopeless world. We'll do it by your power, by your grace, in your name. Amen.